welcome to the Great War Podcast, episode number 4, October through November 1914. As usual, please leave any comments or questions on the website at www.thegreatwarpodcast.com. You will notice an increase in the recording quality of this episode. Recently, my brother has given me a quality recorder and a professional microphone. So, thanks, Eric. I appreciate it, and the listeners do also. All right, let's move on with the intro, shall we? I've been waiting for this episode for a while. Last month, we finally saw the armies in the Western Front fight to a standstill. The trenches and barbed wire that would be so common are also starting to show up. This month's episode will show what happened when the two sides finally came to a standstill. While listening, I would like you to consider this. Most of these commanders were trained for a war of mobility with tactics that had been around since the 1700s. Now all of a sudden you couldn't outflank the enemy because he didn't have any flanks. The trenches went from Belgium all the way down to Switzerland. This episode is where these Western Front commanders start experimenting on how to break through. The cost of this experimenting in human lives for the few yards of ground gained would be enormous. On the Eastern Front, Hindenburg and Ludendorff have been pushed back after their failed invasion of Poland. The Austrians have also been beaten by the Russians in their own invasion of Poland. Serbia is still holding out, but their lack of modern artillery and the capacity to make munitions is starting to tell. The Ottomans have taken a couple of cruisers, the Goeben and Breslau, as gifts from the Germans, and now start looking to their old enemy, Russia. So you're going to hear me to pronounce a city in Belgium spelled Y-P-R-E-S. I have called it Ypres, as well as heard it called Ypres. The first British soldiers that served there couldn't pronounce it either, so most just called it Wipers. Just like the British soldiers, I can't figure it out either and plan to honor their memory by further mispronunciation. So when you hear me call a city Ypres, it is the Belgian city of Ypres. At least I think that's how it's supposed to be called. And with that, let's go ahead and start the show.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Trenches are getting deeper and will soon run from the coast in Belgium all the way to Switzerland. It's now impossible to advance without attacking to your front and therefore being attacked as you try to advance. So what do you do? These generals were trained and experienced in mobile warfare, but now all of a sudden you have a static, well-defended line ahead that you can't maneuver around. You can attack, but down inside you know that you're going to throw away soldiers' lives to make it just to the enemy's trenches. The lesson since August tells you that the enemy artillery will be pounding your side as soon as they attack. Then they have to advance through sticky mud till they get close enough for the enemy machine guns to open up on them. Finally, they need to cross the barbed wire that the enemy has strung up all over the place, all with the artillery, machine guns, and rifles of the enemy's firing at them. We left the BEF in Flanders in mid-October. They are digging in and creating defenses. The Germans have most of the high ground in the area. In the last episode, I stated that the Germans retreated and the British followed them into this salient. That wasn't quite true. The British and the French lines weren't shaped as a definite salient yet at this early part of October. They did, however, bulge into the German lines. However, things for the British are going to change soon. The Germans have one last attack in store before the winter sets in. Last month I mentioned Langemarck, which was the first big battle in this new age of trench warfare. It would set the stage for the following battles. The Germans called the battle Kindermord, or, as it's translated, the Child Murder, in reference to the huge amount of untrained college-age students that were killed, while the British defenders knew it as First Ypres. Langmark is a sub-battle within the battle, but it is also commonly used to describe the whole battle. The Belgians have a name for it also. They called it the Battle of the Yser, spelled Y-S-E-R. At least I think I pronounced that right. Our old buddy von Moltke had been replaced by Erich von Falkenhayn on the 14th of September 1914 due to von Moltke's failure to execute the Schlieffen Plan. Falkenhayn was a lifetime soldier and had served in China during the Boxer Rebellion from 1896 to 1903. He was all for pulling his punches in the east and only using limited offensives, as he feared a disgraced Russia would be harder to bring to the bargaining table. That stance would bring trouble from Team Hindenburg-Ludendorff for the next few years. This was because Hindenburg didn't want his part of the war relegated to the sidelines. Falkenhayn believed that the best way to win the war was to kill or maim enough of the enemy to collapse their will to fight. He would have a chance to prove his theories. All along the Western Front, there's deadlock. The Germans lost the race north after the Marne battle, as the British and French were there to block them the whole way. The brave Belgians, who have also moved back down from their defenses at the Channel ports, are now taking their parts of the line also. The Germans don't give up that easily, though. They have many, many patriotic young men that have signed up to fight, many of them college-age students. All of these new soldiers start heading for the Western Front with just a few months of training. Among them is a young Austrian. His name is Adolf Hitler. Now, a lot of people attribute gross incompetence to the German leadership over this battle because of the loss of life, especially in the younger and untried units. While I agree that this was a huge mistake in terms of loss of life, I would like to clarify a common misconception about this battle. The German units that fought at First Ypres were not all untrained. The usual idea is that Falkenhayn snapped his fingers and all of a sudden there was a whole untrained army in front of him and he just threw them at the enemy to watch them die. The fact is that some of his army was made up of professional soldiers that he scraped up from other areas. The real tragedy here is that the new units were sent into battle with about 2 months of training, which is the amount of time the war has been going on. Ypres itself is a crossroads city for road and railroad traffic. If the Germans could take it, they could easily transport their supplies and have a clear shot to the English Channel port cities. Once they took the port cities, they could threaten the whole southern shore of Britain and deny them that area for shipping. It would also mean longer run times for British supplies to reach their French allies. It could be the killing blow for the whole British army. Kitchener's new British recruits haven't showed up yet, but some Indian units have entered the fight. Other than that, the British army is the same as July 1914, just a whole lot smaller. They hold the ground directly in front of Ypres, while the French and Belgians have their flanks. The French have been preparing to attack the Germans in the Ypres area. They successfully convinced the British to attack with them also. However, the British failed to recognize the German troop buildup to their east. On the night of the 19th of October, the German artillery opens up. The British artillery responds, but it is designed lighter for a more mobile war, and it is not as effective at this early stage. Some British are killed. The artillery stops the next morning, and the British can hear Germans singing, but can't yet see them. Eventually, dark shapes appear in the fog wearing their distinctive Pickelhaube spiked helmets. The singers are the college students. They're singing in order to help keep formation with other inexperienced German units. The French and British open up on them, literally mowing them down. The Germans break and they start sending their artillery over again, which kills more British. These attacks keep up, though, and eventually the already weakened British start giving up ground. The French and Belgians counterattack the Germans using the British trenches as jumping-off points. They, in turn, are counterattacked and pushed back to the British trenches by the Germans. The Germans then run into the already weakened British trench line. The British were able to repulse them with rifle fire. Germany attacked throughout the night, setting nearby farms alight to light the way for infantry and artillery attacks. The British counterattacked the next morning and pushed the Germans out of the trenches they had won over the last few days. The battle goes on like this for more or less for a few weeks. Eventually, the British are down to plugging the gaps in their lines with cooks and bicycle messengers. However, the Germans are starting to tire also. The Germans next try their luck against the Belgians to the north of Ypres. The Belgians take a beating and the French send reinforcements to them to help prop them up. Still, the Germans come and eventually they take the Belgian town of Dixmude. Belgium in the north is low country, meaning it's at or below sea level. The Belgians made the decision to open the floodgates that keep the ocean out of their fields, saving the last little sliver of Belgium, but also making most of it unfarmable. Little Belgium didn't have a choice at this point, though. It was either poison their own farmland or give up. By the next night, the flooding had created a lagoon 11 miles wide and 4 feet deep. Germany abandoned her advance and reconsolidated her reinforcements as her right flank was now secured. The fighting has pushed the lines around the British and now resembles the salient that is so famous. Finally, around the 14th of November, the attack started to taper off due to heavy snowfall and freezing weather. This type of fighting will dominate the Western Front till about 1918. The main differences will be the death toll will only climb and the duration of the battles will only increase. These are the casualties for the Kinderhorn. During the battle, the Belgians lost 18,000 men. The French, around 50,000 men. The British, 58,000 men. And the Germans, 130,000 men. Neither side made any significant gains during the battle, save for the Germans taking Messines Ridge. It was the German capture of Messines Ridge that would be the source of so much fighting later on, as the ridge helped form the salient around the British positions at Ypres. One last thing on First Ypres before we continue on. One of the British commanders was a man by the name of Douglas Haig. I feel he needs to be introduced here to understand the way the British would fight future battles. Haig was born in 1861 and joined the BEF in 1885. He served in the Mahdi Uprising, the Boer War, and India. He was one of the British commanders around Ypres in October. He started the battle with 18,000 men. 2 weeks later, on the 12th of November, he was down to 3,000 men. Haig came away from the battle with the feeling that had the Germans just maintained the attack a little longer, they would have been successful. In 1915, he would be promoted to Commander-in-Chief of the BEF. He and Erich von Falkenhayn would use the same basic tactics. Amass a large group of men, use your artillery to pound the other side, then send your guys over to mop up. Sounds simple, right? So, let's wind this down and head over to the Eastern Front and see how Hindenburg and Ludendorff are doing. We left off of the Eastern Front with Hindenburg and Ludendorff retreating after an unsuccessful attack into Poland. They made it back to their lines by early November. The reason they were operating in an area that should have been the Austro-Hungarian responsibility is that the Austrians were just falling apart. They haven't won a real battle yet. Now, the Russians have some of the Austrians' frontier fortresses under siege. The Germans know that if Austria is invaded, it will leave them open to attack from the southeast. Therefore, they are starting to help their allies with direct military assistance. Hindenburg knew that the Russians were massing an army for an invasion of Silesia. He wanted a repeat of Tannenberg earlier in the year, as well as another invasion of Poland. This would take pressure off of the Austrians and hopefully spoil the Russian invasion of Silesia. He sent the 9th Army out to flank the Russians around Lodz from the north. The invasion was kicked off on the 11th of November 1914. They attacked the Russian 1st Army under Rennenkampf. You may remember him from episode number 2. He was the commander that had his army mauled from Syrian lakes. The Russians promptly fell apart and the Germans were clear to advance on Lodz. Hindenburg and Ludendorff wanted Lodz because it would open up transport lines for a further attack on Warsaw. The Russians immediately recalled the troops heading for the invasion of Silesia. These Russian troops turned around and started heading back into Poland, some of them marching 60 miles in just 2 days. Suddenly, the Germans started having their supply columns attacked from their right, while simultaneously another Russian army started attacking their front on the 18th. The weather was turning quickly now, and the temperatures were dropping to 10 degrees. The German advance ground to a halt. The Russians started to get the upper hand on the Germans. So, for now, we're going to leave the Germans hanging right there till next month. It would take a long time to tell the rest of that story, and I'm just not up for it for this episode. So, moving on. One interesting thing about this war is the speed of communications. On the Western Front, around Ypres at this time, the battered French and British thought they would be all right if they could only hold on till the Russians won at Lodz. Meanwhile, the Austrians are licking their wounds except for the Serbian front. They will have a surprise in store for next episode, but that will have to wait till then, as I'm trying to keep the show to events that happened within more or less 30 days of 100 years ago. The Serbians are still fighting the Austrians that have established a beachhead in their country. The Serbs even score a first in the war by tunneling under an enemy trench. Then they would hollow out a room and pack it with explosives. They would explode it just before an infantry assault. This practice would become very popular on the Western Front later in the war. The Serbs and their allies, the Montenegrins, are running short of ammunition, though. Artillery shells are almost non-existent, as there are only about 100 made in the whole country in a day. The rest they have to import from Greece. On the 5th of November, the Austrians attack with more vigor than before. Despite the Serbs fighting desperately, they gave ground. In order to avoid spreading his lines too thin, the Serb commander Putnik pulled back his troops and abandoned the northern one quarter of the country. Austria finally realized part of the goal that had sent the world into war. On the 2nd of December, Belgrade was in Austrian hands. As we talked about in the first episode, the Ottomans had been this boogeyman to Europe for centuries. They had launched several major invasions and had come very close to succeeding. In 1914, however, they were corrupt and backward compared to the other nations. However, the Germans needed someone that could strike at Britain's trade. Now, the Ottomans probably wouldn't be able to invade India immediately, but they did have one side of a piece of waterfront property called the Suez Canal. If they could hurt Britain's trade enough, they might be able to knock them out of the game economically without committing to an offensive on the Western Front. The Ottomans could also threaten southern Russia. More Russian reinforcements are arriving every day to join armies, and soon the Austrians and Germans will be vastly outnumbered. Therefore, when you look at a map and see how close the Ottomans are to India and Russia, well, looks pretty tempting to ally with them if you're a German. The Ottomans were led by a man named Enver Pasha. He was born in 1881 in Istanbul. He joined the Turkish army in 1903 and quickly rose through the ranks. In 1908, he participated in the Young Turk Revolution. This revolution reinstated the previously banned parliament and constitution. Soon he went to Germany as an attaché. There, he quickly appreciated the German military efficiency and soon openly admired them. In 1911, however, Italy invaded modern-day Libya. Enver led a defense of the area but had to withdraw due to the Ottoman entry into the Balkan Wars, which was a greater threat. The loss of Libya cost Enver's political party their control of the government. In 1912, the Ottomans suffered severe losses in military action in those Balkan Wars. This, in turn, brought down Enver's political opponents. He led another coup in 1913, and this time introduced a triumvirate of himself and two other leaders that had received the title Pasha. On the night of the 29th of October 1914, Ottoman warships started attacking the Russian ports of Odessa, Sevastopol, and Theodosia. The vessels, including the Goeben and Breslau that the Germans had given them at the start of the war. The objective was to destroy naval bases in those cities and the Russian Black Sea fleet if the opportunity presented itself. The attack in Odessa was somewhat of a success, with the Russian mine layers sunk and all other Russian ships damaged and retreating. However, the Russians telegraphed ahead and the rest of the Ottoman raids did not enjoy the same level of success. they engaged the Russian Black Sea fleet on the way back to Istanbul and sent the Russians fleeing there. Russia would declare war on the Ottomans on the 2nd of November. So here's some other stuff about Enver Pasha before we close on him. On the declaration of the Ottoman entry into the war, Enver ordered all males to report to recruiting stations. The army wasn't ready for the influx of men and thus caused long delays. We don't think about it in our mechanized time period, but fall is when a largely agrarian society needs to be harvesting crops. Therefore, the crops for that year failed, which would cause more problems later on. He was also another one of these guys that thought that he was a master strategist. The advisors the Germans sent to the Ottomans disagreed, though. We'll follow him a little bit more next episode. Well, that's it for this month. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did working on it. Also, I hope that the new shorter format is a little bit more functional for you, as I know most people don't have 30 to 40 minutes to sit still and listen to a podcast. Next month, we're going to go back to Hindenburg and Ludendorff and see if they escaped the Russian trap. Anyway, I hope you all have a good day. This is the Great War Podcast. We'll see you next month.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.